Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Vera Wilson, the founder and president of Astral Artistic Services. The nonprofit has been providing career services to some of the most promising young classical musicians in the country for the past 15 years. Susan Lewis looks ahead to a concert by the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, featuring three works inspired by grief that also encompass greater themes. And David Patrick Stearns profiles Michael Hirsch. The Haverford-based pianist and composer's The Vanishing Pavilions has just been released on CD. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Astral Artistic Services is a Philadelphia-based organization whose mission is to discover promising young classical music talent, give them the support they need to develop their solo careers, and help promote them through concert series and outreach work in the community. Founded in 1992 by Vera Wilson, Astral began by presenting musicians in people's homes. It has now become a well-known barometer of upcoming talent, with a roster of successful alumni and a regular, well-attended concert series in Philadelphia's Trinity Center for Urban Life at 22nd and Spruce Streets. This year, the organization is celebrating its 15th anniversary with a series of concerts featuring current Astral artists, as well as some of the by now many successful musicians who Astral has helped become established. When I spoke with Astral president and founder Vera Wilson, I first asked her about the void that Astral was created to fill.
Astral was created to be an advocate for young musicians who are graduating from conservatories, who are pursuing solo careers, and who really don't have the same backup that musicians who are going into an orchestra or into an opera company or into a chorus have. We take them on at these very early stages, and we offer all our services free of charge, and we have a concert series in which we present them and introduce them to the public.
But Astral is more than just a concert promoter. There's a lot happening as well behind the scenes.
What happens behind the scenes is the very substantial outreach program. The outreach programs serve the dual purpose of providing a medium for our musicians to perform and in the process also inform and teach the audiences. This is particularly so in the schools in Philadelphia, many of which do not have any music programs, and where we see this as providing a real service to the schools.
Tell me a little bit about how you ended up in Philadelphia and then how you got to the point where you said, I see a need for young musicians and I'm going to fill it, because a lot of people have great ideas, they don't always necessarily act on them.
My first thought about doing something like an Astral came when I was about 17 and I attended youth orchestra concert, and I thought, all these budding musicians, I wonder where they'll end up. And then sort of life took over, you know, I got married, I had children, and I moved around the world a fair amount. And then my husband's work brought us here to Philadelphia. So for 12 years, I stayed at home. And then when the last one went to school, I started to explore what might be available here. So I chose to work at Curtis as a volunteer. What I found at Curtis was that the greatest commodity that I could offer was my time, my networking skills, and my interest in assisting them. And eventually, in 1991, I was able to found Astral as it is today, with almost nothing to begin other than the interest to make it work.
And work it has.
Well, it has, but it hasn't been without years of tenacious patience. The first concerts were in patrons' homes. The first concert series was at the Ethical Society and at the Free Library. And I remember the first concert, we had 27 people in the audience. And today, it's a different story. We seem to have a niche. Since we don't have artists with big names when we first begin working with them, the confidence is in the organization, in Astral, that what we're putting on is going to be a good program with a superb artist.
There's been a lot of recent media attention on one of Astral's alums, Simona Dinnerstein. Remind us, if you will, of some of the other great successes you've had over the last 15 years.
Well, there's Suvin Kim, violinist Suvin Kim, who came to Astral when he was 19 and showed great promise. And, of course, within 4 or 5 years, he went to do the almost impossible. And we gave him his recital debut of the Paganini Caprices after he won the Paganini competition. And that was, I think, his second recording was of the Paganini Caprices. Perhaps he wouldn't have gone in that direction had he not had his debut with us at the time. Jason Vio, the guitarist. Jason came again to, when he was very young. He was 21. He had an instrument that isn't your typical instrument to be very successful. And in his family, at least in Suvin's family, there was some musical background, and there's none whatsoever in Jason's. And by presenting him, by taking him into the schools, by master classes, by CDs, he's just a really big name artist with great success right now.
What are your hopes for the future?
It's twofold. I mean, obviously, the interest is in the musicians themselves and continuing to create inroads for them. But where Astral is today in relation to what it was when we first began in 1991, I also want to prove that if you believe in what you're doing and if you have the passion to stick with it, that it's really, it has nothing to do with having money. It has to do with just forging ahead and finding a way, and things will eventually come.
Astral Artistic Services alum Jason Vio performing Albéniz, Rumores de la Caleta, ending that interview with Astral's president and founder, Vera Wilson. Celebrations of the organization's 15th birthday continue with a concert on Sunday, November 11th at 3 at the Trinity Center for Urban Life at 22nd and Spruce Streets in Philadelphia. Featured artists include pianist Michael Mizrahi and Koji Atwood, with special guests Don Liuzzi and Chris DeVinny, both percussionists with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Music, grief, and memory are intertwined in a performance this evening of John Adams' Pulitzer Prize-winning composition for chorus and orchestra on the Transmigration of Souls. Commissioned by the New York Philharmonic for the opening of its 02-03 season, the work was subsequently performed all over the world. It headlines a program that also included Karol Szymanowski's Stabat Mater and James Primosh's Fire Memory, River Memory. Tonight's local premiere of the Adams work will be sung by the 125 adult singers of the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia and 72 children in the combined choruses of the Pennsylvania Girl Choir and the Bel Canto Children's Chorus, accompanied by 70 musicians in an augmented chamber orchestra of Philadelphia. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers how this music taps into memory and contributes to an individual and collective sense of identity.
On that sunny September morning, in the minutes after two hijacked planes flew into the World Trade Center towers, chaos reigned. As buildings full of people burned in an otherwise clear blue sky, and more people fled along the narrow canyon floors of Wall Street, the air filled with once important documents, letters, faxes, deal memos. It was this image of millions of pieces of floating paper that John Adams says stuck in his mind when he was creating On the Transmigration of Souls, which begins with street sounds and a small child's voice.
Missing. Missing.
As vivid as these images are, Mendelssohn Club music director Alan Harler says the work is about more than 9/11.
Each listener is recalling not just what they felt on 9/11, but what they have felt in all of their emotional life.
Any music can stimulate a host of memories. James Primosh, professor of music at the University of Pennsylvania, composed the work Fire Memory, River Memory, also on this program. He says memory is integral to music.
Because it's a time art. So within the piece, memory is at play. What you remember from happening in the piece a few moments earlier, or quite some time earlier in the piece. There's memory within the piece. There's memory of other musics. There's memory of things that the music reminds you of that are not other musics.
Music is not the only trigger for memory in this program. As choral music, each piece has a text, creating multiple narratives within each work.
The narrative that is inherent in the text itself, the musical narrative, the sort of larger narrative that happens when those two narratives intertwine.
Each work on this program taps into the inner recesses of the mind. Each addresses some aspect of grief. And each, says Alan Harler, relates to the very idea in John Adams' title, The Transmigration of Souls.
The meaning that we know mostly is moving from one place to another, but it could also be the transition of one state of being to another, as in being alive and being dead. Or it could also imply the movements of souls from one state to another. So in a way, On the Transmigration of Souls, for me, fit all three pieces.
Carol Szymanowski's Stabat Mater was commissioned as a requiem for the late wife of a Warsaw businessman in the 1920s.
He kept putting the writing of the piece off. And then when his niece was dying and he saw his sister grieving, that's when he decided to finish the piece.
Karen Slack is the soprano in this Mendelssohn Club performance of Stabat Mater.
I always see the soprano as the angel because her music is so beautiful, these long lines that soar high throughout the piece.
Although the text is about the mother of Christ watching him die on the cross, Slack says it expresses more than sorrow.
The joy and the remembrance and the heartfelt part of grieving as well, because grieving is a beautiful thing too, in a different way.
Remembrance is also integral to Fire Memory, River Memory, composed by James Primosh in 1998, using the text from two poems by Denise Levertov. The first, What Were They Like?, is about the people of Vietnam. Six questions are posed by the men's chorus.
Were they inclined to quiet laughter? And the answer given to the women is, Sir, laughter is bitter to the burned mouth. So there's a certain naivete, you might say, about the questions, and then there's the experience of the horror of war that informs the answers that are given.
In contrast to the other works on the program, Adams' On the Transmigration of Souls relates to a specific, real event. The text is taken from the flyers put up around Manhattan after the towers came down. Those flyers, describing missing loved ones, trigger instant memories, still fresh in the minds of most audience members, and all but the youngest of the performers. Joy Hirakawa is the music director of the Bel Canto Children's Chorus, which sings the children's part along with the Pennsylvania Girls Choir. It is difficult music, with dissonance and layering of sounds, conveying a sense of chaos. One day in rehearsal, Hirakawa says a girl put up her hand.
And said, well, where did this text come from? Tell us about this text. And so I had to then explain, and the look on her face and the other children, when it dawned on them and they understood what it was they were saying when they're reading text, a gold chain around his neck, a silver ring on his little finger.
Hirakawa did more than explain. She says the children needed to understand the reality behind the work if they were to sing it properly and if they were to be prepared for the reaction it might bring. In September, she took the group to Ground Zero.
And their whole commitment to the piece changed. They wanted then to do so badly, to do the best job they possibly could to honor these people.
Whatever the vehicle, memory is a critical part of being fully connected to ourselves and to one another.
We're humans, so we remember. That's part of our consciousness, our self-consciousness, our self-awareness. That's part of our sense of being alive. And yet, we deaden ourselves by not being mindful, by not being aware, by not honoring memory.
We check our emotions, but art, and especially music with text, I think, is what allows us to release those emotions.
Music can take us to another time, another place, another part of ourselves in our reservoir of memories. Whether it's memory of joy or sorrow, of persons we have loved, or of circumstances that join together create the continuity of our lives. The deliberate, willful act of remembering helps us understand where we have been, who we are, and what we might become.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, the combined choruses of the Pennsylvania Girl Choir and the Bel Canto Children's Chorus, are accompanied by an augmented chamber orchestra of Philadelphia in a performance of John Adams on the Transmigration of Souls, Carol Szymanowski's Stabat Mater, and James Primosh's Fire Memory, River Memory at the Girard College Chapel this evening at 8. Mozart is timeless, Beethoven universal. Schubert speaks to our times, but none of them lived through 9/11 or witnessed some of the more horrifying realities of modern warfare on CNN. Michael Hirsch, the Philadelphia-based composer, has seen these things along with the rest of us, and they seem to go directly into his music, says Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns.
Even if all of the world doesn't want to hear it, the truth doesn't necessarily sound pretty, and it can't be easy to write. But for a decade, this 36-year-old composer has stood on the increasingly genteel contemporary music landscape like a Cassandra of sorts, and never more so than in this new evening-length piano work, The Vanishing Pavilions. A soft-spoken husband and father, as well as a composition professor at Baltimore's Peabody Conservatory, Hirsch was described by his longtime mentor, the late composer George Rochberg, as having the kind of temperament he looks for in a young artistic colleague. Urgent, consumed by his art, and not so well adjusted to the world. But is that an easy way to live?
Oftentimes people ask, I mean, not just me, but I think when one thinks about composers in general or just artists one admires, you know, sometimes it's hard to, especially when you don't know the person, you know, say, wow, is the art that I just experienced, is that person the entity that was the piece? I mean, at least in my case, when I write, I'm in that world, and when I'm not writing, I'm you know, I behave differently, I think differently. That didn't answer your question.
The Vanishing Pavilions was written over 5 years, premiered last year in a concert with the composer himself on piano, and presented by Philadelphia's Network for New Music. Now the piece is released on a double CD set on the Vanguard label, and repeated listening makes for an increasingly haunting experience. The music is inspired by the dark, enigmatic poems of British writer Christopher Middleton, though in no way has the composer set them to music or necessarily even expressed them in music. He seems to have used the words like a fuse to set off some sort of musical explosion. Hirsch suggests, but hardly insists, that audiences read the Middleton poems that are printed in the program notes. But when you do, the correlation between words and music is going to have a different friction with every repeated encounter. Where Middleton's verse speaks of specters, vast, remote, uneasily wagging their heads in shrouds of crushed amethysts, Hirsch's music does this. Over the 5 years that went into the Vanishing Pavilions, much of the composition rigorously took place in his head. And when the time came to write it down 2 years ago, his wife Karen was giving birth to their daughter, Abigail. So much of the work took place in hospital rooms.
It was not a beautiful, clean process of just sitting calmly. You know, there was a lot of wrangling with material. But by that year, you know, everything had become pretty clear. So it felt very clean in terms of, but there was so much work. So yes, it came out of my head, clean but messy.
While learning to play the piece, Michael Hirsch discovered that the sounds he heard in his head required a huge amount of technical virtuosity. One can safely say that the piece expands the possibilities of the piano much as Chopin and Liszt did before him. It's also true that only two or three pianists in the world could successfully wrestle with this piece. But years of demonstrating his music, often playing his orchestral works at the keyboard, have left the composer with the fingers of a god, albeit an extremely discontented one. Vanishing Pavilions is Hirsch's biggest work so far. He found his calling abruptly around his 19th birthday upon encountering Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. Since then, he has achieved a visibility that few composers can dream of. His Symphony No. 2 was commissioned and premiered by the Pittsburgh Symphony under conductor Maurice Janssens. Hirsch was one of the youngest composers to receive a Guggenheim Fellowship. Like Debussy and Berlioz before him, he won the Prix de Rome. In the words of Pittsburgh critic Andrew Druckenbrod, Hirsch is a rare and seemingly contradictory combination of a late bloomer and a prodigy. In recent years, however, his works, some of which have consisted of a dozen or more micro-movements, have been greeted with bafflement and, in one performance by the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, a bit of booing from the audience. The Vanishing Pavilions was written on faith rather than on commission. He had trouble finding a presenter for the premiere before being embraced by the Network for New Music. The lack of an outside impetus meant that Hirsch didn't have to cope with a deadline or accommodate the piece to suit a performer other than himself. But lucky for him, Rockberg impressed upon Hirsch the need for patience and courage.
Well, you know, I'm only human, so, you know, while nothing anybody says or does affects what I'm going to do, it never feels nice if someone doesn't understand or doesn't like something. And it always feels nice if someone does connect with something. I have to write what it is that's important to me. And I do understand that, especially in past years, things have gotten further and further away from the direction that the culture has gone.
The Vanishing Pavilions embodies so much of what I've felt since the war in Bosnia. An increasing disillusionment with the ways of mankind, not to mention a fundamental sense of loss of personal safety. I'm not just talking about the sense of anguish expressed by Michael Hirsch, but the way one musical idea will be thwarted and consumed by another, and another, and yet another in a merciless food chain. What we all want is somebody to say that everything is going to be okay, whether or not it is. Hirsch's final benediction in The Vanishing Pavilions is curious but consoling. It's a succession of 36 ascending chords that propel me into the future, whatever that may be.
Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns writes about Michael Hirsch in tomorrow's paper. Hirsch's Vanishing Pavilions is now out on a Vanguard label double CD and is available from the WRTI Music Service at 1-800-894-4918 or by following the link at our website, www.wrti.org. And that's it for now. Our special thanks this week to Lynn Faust. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.